right, everybody, welcome to Theory Underground. I'm your host, David McCarricker, and today the co-host is Michael Downs. Good to have you, Mikey. And we're joined by Anna Kornblut. Welcome, Anna. How are you doing today?
I'm awesome. It's a little bit hot in Chicago, which is kind of scary in February, but I'm good otherwise. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy to have Mikey on for a conversation with someone who's in his time zone. That never happens.
I'm in Kansas City, so right. Yeah. And it's warm here, unusually warm, but I think we're dipping down back. We're going to get a couple days of winter, I think, on Wednesday, Thursday.
Okay.
And right back up to 70 degree weather or something.
Right.
I'm in Boise. And in Boise, the weather has been very bipolar, but in the, like today, it was nice weather all day, but there was a little blizzard for about an hour where like really big snowflakes were falling. And my cat was in the window trying to figure out what was going on. But everyone, we're here today to talk about a book, a really cool book that just came out. Was it last year?
It was this year. It was the last month, the end of January. Yeah.
It just came out. Yeah. This is fresh off the press, and it's called Immediacy or the Style of Too Late Capitalism. And so I think we'd probably like to just start out with what inspired this work and what is immediacy style.
Yeah, totally. So the book is very clearly inspired by some work by a critic and theorist named Frederick Jameson, who is one of the people who really first advanced the term postmodernism, starting in a 1984 essay in the journal New Left Review to try to understand what's happening in culture after modernism, and to try to understand that in a particularly Marxist way. So to think about aesthetic forms like architecture and literature and television, video, and film, but to think about them as doing some processing of shifts in economic relations. And so that inspiration is there, but there's sort of the question of, are we still in postmodernism? What's our kind of economic situation in 2020? And is it different from what it was in the early 1980s? And I definitely had the sense that was the real kind of initial idea for the book that aesthetic styles are changing, that when we read literature, when we watch TV, especially, original streaming TV, when we consume art in museums or in unmuseums, as they're called, that something different is going on than the kinds of dominant logic that Jameson was describing in postmodernism. And what's that something different? I'm really interested in as a kind of pressure on mediation, a kind of emptying out of representation, a kind of effort to short circuit and, cut to the feeling, right? Direct message. And that pressure being experienced by people who produce art, who feel that there's something illegitimate about it taking a long time to kind of contemplate or get a message, and instead wanting to just be expressed direct, right? And also something about people who consume it, that they think it might be elitist if you have to engage in some processing or some contemplating or deliberating of like what's going on in this poem, and who think also that we should constantly be giving art kind of political report cards, right? And there's a real kind of incompatibility there between aesthetic representation and like a direct political position, because it's not saying it directly, it's saying it indirectly. But why is there this pressure to be direct? And that's kind of, directness is almost a synonym for immediacy, when immediacy is the kind of negating of mediation or the negating of this kind of process of sense making, negating of medium, even like that we don't encounter artistic works in specific media anymore. There's sort of a lot of media blending or genre blending. I'm trying to link all of that pressure, not just to like attitudes about what am I doing when I watch a movie and where's my political message, right? But to shifts in economic values. And so if you look at the kind of patterns over the last 40 years, last 50 years that, you know, Jameson is initially observing the beginnings of, we have what is often avowed by a lot of different kinds of economists and historians as stagnation, or secular stagnation is their word for it, like that the G7 economies aren't really growing by producing more stuff for more people. And there's lots of symptoms of that, like stock buybacks is a big one, or declining rates of daily stock transactions, but where capital isn't investing in producing new stuff. And instead what it's doing is investing in exchanging things faster, right? So if you're not making something, you can still trade faster, or what's called circulation, right? So we get Postmates and we get Uber and we get these forms of kind of trying to intensify, or I say the word immanentize in the book, like, you know, make instant and so on, exchange, cutting out the middleman, you know, so an Uber driver doesn't work for a taxi company, they work for themselves, scare quotes, right? And you summon them with your fingertip. And there's this kind of idea that you're in some kind of, you know, direct relation with your private chauffeur, right? And so I'm trying to relate these pressures on art to these kind of economic changes.
That's excellent. And the word style, I think you had talked about it having a special signification. Maybe you had talked about it in relation to Adorno. I'm not sure. Was that right? Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Sure. Right. So if I'm kind of describing something that's like a little bit dominant, you might say, like, what are some words we could give to that? Like, could we say, oh, there's a logic in contemporary culture, or, oh, there's a dominant ideology, or there is a kind of hegemony, or, and I chose the word style because it was really important to underline that a lot of the art forms that I'm talking about are trying to pretend they aren't art. They're trying to say it's bad to write fiction. They're trying to say it's bad to have abstract cinematography, that the camera should just sort of like be in your face and have a kind of body level perspective. And then also even front facing, kind of like make eye contact with the spectator, right? That it's not good to do theory because like ideas are bad and abstractions are bad. And we should have this just kind of like intimate confessional kind of self-manifestation. Those are all ways of pretending not to have style, right? We're taking down these big things that are in the way, these mediations of distance, or kind of frameworks of abstraction that like the camera might provide, or the invented consciousness that fiction can provide. We're cutting those all out, and we're just giving you the real stuff. Right. So, but that's pretending. And so it was really important to me to name it style as a way of sort of thinking this paradox of like a style that presents itself as unstyled, or why is there just this kind of whole, you know, almost fetish of kind of endless lust for the viscerally affecting right here, right now, real stuff, these kind of profundities of the body or experience that are kind of intransitive, right? They can't be connected to other things. They're just kind of like intensely shimmering. So style was a word that I chose because it highlights that something has been made in a particular way. And I wanted to call attention to these things that are presenting themselves as unstyled still actually do have a style, and even like some aesthetic grammars or forms in common, or things that we can kind of track to study them as indeed still having been made or still situated in a context where there's a broader matrix of economic value and economic imperative that is also trying to sort of cut stuff out, right?
I like what you're saying, because basically, I mean, it's almost like you're doing with style, somewhat like what Sartre did with freedom, where you're saying you're choosing not to choose, you're still choosing. You're saying you're not styling, you're still styling, right?
Right.
But you know, it's interesting too, because I work in a warehouse and work with a lot of Zoomers, Generation Z, and even they, you start talking about, you know, pop culture or whatever, even they will say stuff like, you know, we don't have style the way that boomers and Xers and millennials did. And you think about like the very strong contrast in genres or styles of music or in fashion, right? You ask them, and they'll say like, we don't have a punk style or goth or hip hop or like really like, even when you look at how they dress, it is kind of generic. Nothing stands out. You wouldn't give it its own name or anything. And same with music. They'll say, you know, our pop music kind of doesn't, you know, it's a little like techno infused, but you know, pretty much pop music, and hip hop is okay. Maybe it's a little slowed down now, but they all feel like they're suffering from a lack of generational defining style. And it's funny, tomorrow I'll say, no, you guys have your style. It's no style.
It's no style. Yeah. And I think there's two really interesting things going on there. That's such a good description of like how Zoomers feel, right? One of the things going on there is, how do you see the present, right? How can you tell that you think you're just going about your life, listening to the music that you like, I like this and I like that, and I wear this and I wear that, and I don't really, you know, I don't really put the effort into it to have a style. I just, you do you or whatever, right? But you're actually part of broader networks of practices and habits and meaning that are being, you know, commercially sold to you, or that are being kind of used as the glue of society. So how do you get a feel for the present, right? And so trying to call it style to say like, oh, there's something going on in the present which is different than postmodernism is like one of the gestures the book is trying to make, to say like, how do we get a little distance on everything we're living in the middle of and start to describe it, right? But I do think the other thing that's going on is that they're totally right, that there is this like bizarre kind of falling away of genres, of forms. There's a lot of kind of homogenization of things that are available to us in mass culture. And we can think about why that is. You know, in music, that might be because there are certain, you know, platforms that are predominating, and certain producers and individual, you know, kind of consolidated companies and labels that are predominating, and they might have kind of like a house aesthetic or something, but we don't, but they sort of hide the fact that they're exerting such a controlling influence. There's a really interesting article by a guy named Mitch Theriault about the producer Jack Antonoff, and like how much his sound just sounds the same and how powerful he is, right? And we, you know, we also might think like, oh, there's infinite TV available to me on the stream, and I can just choose anything that's tailored to my likes, and Netflix algorithm is does just for you, and so on. And that seems like diverse. And so like, I don't have any style in that, or I don't have any preferences in that, right? But there are, it turns out, a lot of really surprising common aesthetic features of the stuff that's made as original streaming content. So I think it's so interesting the way that you phrase that. It's like, how can we see the present? How can we see what our style actually is, and that it is different from, you know, style in the early 2000s? And that if we look back on it in 2040, it probably will look like, oh yeah, that had features that we could delineate, just like bell bottoms or whatever, right? But also, what if the specific features are a kind of tendency to like homogeneity or slurry or, you know, indistinction?
One thing that I would like to ask is about this. Well, I love this quote. From your regular, I'll say just to the audience, this is one of the most enjoyable works of theory that I've read in the last 10 years, for sure. It's and really I've only been into theory for 10 years. So that's, you know, the point is there's like this weird way that your voice and the form kind of matches the content. Like I was listening to it while working at the Amazon warehouse where I worked yesterday. And I think I got like halfway through it, and I was like listening to this robot reading fast, but it's just like, okay, so, which is already kind of insane. I understand. Wow. Like it's like, it's not the way to actually read books. I know it's not in any way, shape or form, like, an adequate replacement, but it's good enough when we don't have the time and energy and we're working. But it's also kind of just how I get like that sort of window shopper's first pass on something or like maybe it's like a speed date, so that I can go, you know what, I'm going to go actually sit down with that book for a few hours. And I just wanted to say I was sold on it. At the level of style, separate from the actual arguments, which I think are fantastic. And I think, you know, it really has, there's this whole thing about instantaneity and immediacy that I've been thinking about a lot, especially with the critical media theory stuff that we do at Theory Underground. So this is now, you know, canon, this text, but the style though, there's something about how you wrote it that makes it feel like this succession of like impressions. I don't really understand like how you did it. And is this your normal writing style, or was this something you were developing for this text?
Well, thank you so much for saying that. And also, like, I'm very honored that you listen to this while you're working. And I hope that you also feel that the style is one related to those compressions in your work experience, right? Instant fulfillment is what you spend all of your time intensely doing, literally, right? Yeah. Instant fulfillment, you know, that kind of just go, 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 right? That is the kind of speed sense of immediacy is shaping how we experience the books that we were listening to at triple speed or at 1.5 feet or whatever, so that we can get through them and nobody has time to relax, but they have to, like, you know, be caught up on the latest like culture and so on, right? So that freneticism and that intensity of what you're doing warehouse, like that's so what I'm trying to get at and how it has a broader logic, right? I thought hard about how to write this book because it was different from other books I'd written in its subject matter, chiefly because I was trying to talk about a lot of stuff, right? I felt like if I want to be convincing that this is a kind of dominant logic, then I need a lot, right? I need a lot of examples, and I'm going to deal with them fairly quickly rather than, like, I've written books where I read one novel for 30 pages or something, right? And that's not how this book is working. And that means that there are places where I'm sort of saying, okay, here are like 10 shows that use this kind of cinematography, or here are, you know, 7 novels that use this kind of temporality structure, or, right, like I'm rushing through groups of things to try to be a little bit encyclopedic or to try to get at the scale or capture the scale. And I think that can give you a sense like that I'm not lingering at so long with the objects, or even that there are sentences where I say, oh, here's 7 novels that do this. That's almost like a list, right? It's almost like you're kind of moving through that quickly. The other thing that I was thinking about a lot when I was writing is I wanted there to be, you know, big theory words and, like, you know, historical narrative and kind of taking distance from stuff and lots of abstractions. But I wanted to be synthesizing those things or sort of like making them bring to bear them on immediacy. But I also wanted it to feel a little bit conversational or a little bit maybe funny at times, but like that there would be different kinds of like, one sentence here would be a Jameson sentence and one sentence here would be a meme or something, where there was like friction between the kinds of language. Cause I was trying to get at some of the thicknesses that would mean like, wait, whoa, I can't read all of these sentences the same way, or, oh, that surprised me, or let me slow down and sort of go back. Where did that big theory word come from? Or, you know, how do we arrive at this? So I didn't want it to be intuitive or too smooth. You know, I wanted it to be a little bit like, this is weird, but that might have an effect of immersion, which I, you know, am worried about too. So into the thing to describe.
No, I think whatever it is it's something where people should probably take note just if they're thinking about writing theory, like, because you are mixing so many different theory styles, it's kind of refreshing. So I'll say that, but I wanted to read this one quote because I like how, you know, the books that you kind of talk about, this list of books that are sort of manifestos or reinterpretations of capitalism, or what phase of capitalism are we in? And so I just kind of want to read that off for people. It says, The theory of new media's decisive impact often braces the distinction of the contemporary as denominated through numerous diagnoses and manifestos. Digital capitalism, 1999, information capitalism, 2000, communicative capitalism, 2005, surveillance capitalism, 2014, platform capitalism, 2016, and even no longer capitalism, but something worse, rule by a vectoralist class, 2016. Of course, we could probably add, you know, the techno-feudalism thesis from, right? There's just like this whole list, but then you're kind of coming in, and of course you go on in the quote to get into the different kind of economic conceptions, such as like the fourth and or third industrial revolution and those kinds of things. But I guess I kind of just want to set you up to talk a little bit about how you see this as sort of quilting that lineage of attempts to conceptualize the field.
Oh yeah, that's an awesome question. So I think that lineage is really important, right? Like as we were just starting our conversation, like how do you put a name on the present, right? Or how do you, I think one of the jobs of theory is to try to provide us with descriptions or categories that we can think with, right? So does platform capitalism as a concept help us think that something different is happening from just commodity capitalism or just the moment of multinational capitalism or mercantile capitalism or finance capitalism, right? So I think the categories are really, really important. I also think their proliferation in the 21st century is a kind of sign that people are trying to figure out, like, what is actually happening in our economic base. Like, it's still capitalism, right? All of these are still capitalism. But when is a quantitative change in how capitalism works a qualitative one? When is a change in how we do business one that becomes a change in how we make art or a change in belief, right? When you're trying to put names on these almost historical periods, also, are they claims about transitions in time? Are they claims about just changes in ideology? And I think a lot of the ones that are in that list are people who are trying to make sense of, is the internet a new phase of capitalism? Is the digital a new kind of production? Are all the tools that are made available to us from email on to Google, on to ChatGPT, right? Are those tools actually enhancing productivity? And it's taken a while for people to sort of track and figure out that they're not really. So like that third industrial revolution is kind of like the promise that we're going to have this total transformation expansion of capitalism in this way, because we're going to be making all kinds of new things. And it turns out not to have really made a difference in the growth trajectories and profit trajectories in the G7s. Nonetheless, we do, I think, have a different cultural style as a result of these media technologies. And so that's kind of one of the distinctions I try to make in the chapter called Circulation, is sort of how we think about, we're still in this tendency of intensified circulation, intensified exchange that started with globalization, the compression of time and space is like David Harvey's name for some of those things, right? And now we just have, you know, you want it, we get it, right? We have all kinds of instantaneity. So that's a sort of trajectory of intensification. So maybe it means things haven't changed so much in the base. It's not that we're in feudalism again, and we could talk about that more if you want to, right? But it's that we do nonetheless have this convergence of our styles of making art and making meaning, or in this case of rejecting art and rejecting meaning, with that instantaneity, cut out the middleman kind of economic base. I think the feudalism hypotheses are so interesting. They really, really are, because they're trying to say, like, things are getting extremized, right? There's an incredible ballooning of wealth at the very, very top. And on the one hand, you know, capitalism is always about that kind of opposition, right? Marx says in the Communist Manifesto, it's the simplification of class antagonisms, right? That you just have two classes, and they are, you know, there are people who are rich and there are people who are miserable, and those are in structural relation to each other. But on the other hand, the kind of ballooning that we're seeing is really unprecedented and is related to specific legal changes in the tax code and specific, again, the stock buybacks thing and kind of capital that doesn't have anywhere to go except to be reallocated to wealthy individuals instead of being invested in production. And the kind of precarity that we're seeing on the other side is really quite extreme. extreme also, you know, how hard it is to just afford an apartment in the United States, right? There's almost no city in the United States where a person working 40 hours a week, minimum wage job, can afford an apartment. Like, those are extreme, terrible conditions, right? And there's a lot of that polarization that is happening by virtue of rent. Think about what streaming is even. We don't own the CD anymore, right? You don't have the thing at your house. If you stop paying your subscription, you won't have that music, right? And does that mean that as a consumer, you're in a different kind of relationship to that corporation than you were in an era of less rent-based and more kind of commodity transaction-based stuff? I think trying to put names on that stuff is really, really important. And at what point are those differences really changing the power structure that we're in, or really changing the ideological structure that we're in? So I think it's really good to have that kind of debate about the, you know, neo-feudalism hypothesis. It really is. But we are seeing lots of things that remain just tendencies of capitalism that Marx already described, but they keep extremizing.
Yeah, that one in particular, it's not that I've done super deep research into the topic, but it definitely is getting at what I take to be a real complication in class composition itself, because in the, you know, the age of Charles Dickens, it was like, you're a proletarian or you're a capitalist. And if you were a proletarian, you knew you were a proletarian, as opposed to now, where people think of themselves first and foremost as some kind of a consumer identity. And the way to get out of the rank and file working class is through college. That didn't exist right at the time. Like, that wasn't an idea. Oh yeah, you can go to college and then you can be a part of one of these professions, or, you know, then mm-hmm. you can get into the management. It was more, no, you want to get to the management, you just work your way up within any given, say, factory or whatever. Well, anyway, so I think it is really interesting, and all of these, you know, do have their own way of reconceptualizing the situation. But I think that yours has maybe gotten to something special about our actual media environment. You know, I'll put it that way. You know, Sherry Turkle, in her Reclaiming Conversation, she talks a lot about how what's being sold to us is friction-free living, right? Like the idea that that we're able to kind of just like remove ourselves from difficulty. And what she doesn't bring in, because she doesn't have that Marxist basis, or at least she doesn't ever bring it in, is the, it's like, nobody thinks that work is going to be friction-free, right? Of course, there is like this kind of like, oh, we have like this, this more nice managerial approach, you know, they, especially at Amazon, you know, you know, they always want to know about how your experience is and stuff like that. But it's kind of just like, it's almost like, because we've put in the work to make the money, now we want to, now we don't want to have any friction outside of work. Right. And so, and this goes, you know, Adorno goes somewhere with that, right? That's because we're supposed to be doing recreational activities, which is to say recreating our labor power. That's the point of our free time, is just to get back to work. Right. And so that's where Mikey and I both come in with all the stuff we do with time energy theory and things like that. But I kind of wanted to pass it back over to you, Mikey, before I've got a couple more questions that I'll definitely want to get into, but I kind of want to let you take it for a bit here so we can get into some of Mikey's got some really exciting stuff here. So.
Well, first off, yeah, like that's so much of our work focuses on this concept Dave has developed called time energy, right? And yeah. Like, this is his book, Time Energy. Actually, the second edition just came out and Slavoj wrote a foreword for it.
Oh, awesome.
So that just came out, what, today, Dave, on Amazon?
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you. And so, I thought I heard something. So, no, yeah, this gets to this idea. And honestly, like I've thought about the issue with capitalism and time, and Adorno was very influential because he has that great little essay on free time. Mm-hmm. And so that gets us into this whole thing of, you know, so Dave and I, we both understand that what capitalism isn't going to give us, at least not willingly, is large repeatable blocks of our time energy. Which, Dave, if you want to give the full formula, go ahead. But no, go ahead.
Yeah. What I've kind of simplified it down to is just saying large energy infused repeatable blocks of time that are reliably throughout your week. Right. Without those, you can't do most things that you would do if you were following or exploring your higher human capacities. And all that's left is energy without time, which is frenetic, restless, or at least it's without repeatable time, right? Like if it's not reliable, repeatable time, but you feel energized, inspired to do something, you can take up the violin, but you're not going to be able to get anywhere with it because you're not going to find that kind of time again. Right. Okay. And then the opposite of that kind of time is just energy. It's time without energy, which is garbage time, which is, you know, it's good for video games and binging Netflix, and it's not good for much else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's.
No, and so the way I see your work connecting to what we're doing is, for me, what, like, because here the if we talk about like the zeitgeist with young people, we're done with work. We don't want to work anymore. Our bosses bitch about it all the time. You know, people just don't want to work anymore. You're damn right we don't want to work anymore because we have nothing to show for it. And you know, this mode we're all in, which is, no, wealth to us is not just money, having $1 billion, it's not having to work all the time.
Right.
And what we find more and more when you're working more and more and you have less and less money, the status of wage laborer puts you in a kind of existential immediacy. That's all you are. Now, the great Hegelian quote, and Derrida also says it, which is immediacy is always mediated, right? Yeah. But which is to say, there's a whole web of mediation that's making us feel immediately trapped in our identities as wage slaves, right? And so what time energy would do is, like, we're trying to think the conditions of subjects of mediation, which is to say, I want to learn to play the violin. I want to learn a new language, which is, it's all mediating between different aspects of life, right? Opposed to the oppressive immediacy of just being locked in to the identity of wage laborer with no way to facilitate any types of different potentials you have within yourself. And so this is a way that the word immediacy and what you're doing with it really resonates with us, because we feel like we're suffocated or trapped in the immediacy of futureless wage slavery.
Yeah. That's so powerful. It's really important to be able to tell the story of that, like to narrate it, to think about it collectively, to think about what are the conditions that, you know, changed historically to make work be this way, right? And to think about, yeah, your human experience of temporality, where you have a longing to be creative. And also, I love this idea of the repeatability that's necessary for our creative kind of flourishing and for just our human capacities, right? People need to know from their Starbucks or Amazon manager what their schedule is going to be ahead of time so that they can repeatedly schedule their own childcare or their own reading or their own violin lesson or their own exercise or anything they need to, you know, so those structures or even you could say forms of like the schedule and the monthly schedule or something, like those actually help hold things in place for us in ways that are really sustaining and important. But you have to have that experience of time as not just empty and not just instant and not just stuck in itself, that like you can't see any future, you don't have any kind of program of the schedule or program of what will repeat, or also just-in-time logistics is killing our future. Right, yours individually as people who are doing that, you know, grueling work, right? And all of ours collectively in that, like this, you know, why I need a new box of crayons or a new bra on the same day delivery or whatever is ecocidally energy expensive and it's burning out the planet, right? I think this time energy concept sounds really, really, really important.
Oh, sorry. No, keep going.
Well, I was just going to say the futurelessness is something that I try to think about a little bit. Like, immediacy is a temporal feeling, right? And it's, and it is the feeling of no future, that you're stuck in a vibrating present that's not going to go anywhere, that is somehow self-identical to itself, stagnant and imminent.
Yeah, I was just going to say that Bezos, you know, in an interview recently, I don't know if it's recent, but I saw it recently. He was saying that he was like, you know, there's not a lot of there's not a lot of certainties. You know, like you can't know the future. But one thing that I know for certain is that, you know, in a year from now or in 10 years from now, people aren't going to want their packages to come any slower. In fact, people are always going to want to get their packages faster. And so that's the one thing that I'm really prioritizing. And so it is kind of what you're talking about, which is this, instead of investing in new things or whatever, it's like more of this investing in speed itself. And of course, bringing back Cernichik's book there, it would be the platform, right? He's building the platform at a loss, right? He's taking a loss for now. I don't know what that means when he's making, like, I think it's like 1 million per hour or something like that. Like, I think it's something stupid, a lot more than that. I think like 36 million per hour, whatever. It's something ridiculous, but it adds up to like hundreds of millions, really, really quickly. Someone in the lunchroom yesterday was showing me, I was kind of distracted, but it's all I registered was it's a lot. It's insane. And so it's crazy that this company is constantly building at a loss just to monopolize the field, but he's still making that much, right? Like, so that's where I'm like, there's some kind of cognitive dissonance there. But
he's saying, he's making a pronouncement about what human beings want, like, oh, the universal desire for speed, right? And I think it's really important to unpack that, because it's not actually true, right? One thing I found is that I felt more reliant on things like Amazon when I became a mom, because I was working and I was trying to reproduce the human species, right? And we don't have a culture that, or an economic structure that helps share the work of social reproduction, right? And so I'm racing around, like, you know, commuting, and like, I gotta get groceries and I gotta pick up my kid from the childcare. I gotta get there before the, you know, and I don't have time to make an extra stop for diapers when I'm out of them. So I gotta order them. And I'm so harried that I don't even realize I'm out of diapers. And then I order them for overnight or whatever. Like, that desire isn't just a spontaneous, like, I need my shit right this second, right? At the expense of other people's lives, right? The conditions that UPS drivers work in, the conditions that you guys work in, it's not a just spontaneous natural desire. It's made out of the conditions of my own work and the conditions of other people's work and our economic values, where we don't like slow down and prize and value care, for instance.
And don't you think it's this inverse ratio of the more they deprive us of time, energy, the more they have to speed up things because we don't have the time, energy to go do the stuff. Right. And so it's more of like, we keep stealing your time, energy, more and more and more. But here we got new services that supplement or attempt to make up for it. And it's like, it doesn't make up for it. And then the other thing, I was talking to our friend Todd McGowan last week, and I was telling him this example I have. It's going to be in one of my upcoming books, but you know, this whole thing of like, oh, we're making life more enjoyable because we're making things more immediate. I mean, just on the level of libidinal economy, it does not work. So
it is, right.
My example is comparing Netflix to the video store. The video store is far more enjoyable for a couple of reasons. One, it wasn't always open. Two, you couldn't rent every movie when you went. Right. You could get a couple, three or four, most, if you were lucky. Closing time was always the most exciting when you're renting movies. It's like, okay, hurry up, the obstacle, the limit, you know. And all of this facilitates enjoyment, jouissance, right? There's obstacles in the way. There's, you know, and with Netflix, half the time you scroll through it, you never find anything because everything's always available. It's all immediate. And you find that there's far less jouissance caught up in Netflix watching. Now, maybe you can find some like in binge watching shows, there's something excessive in that, but definitely there's more enjoyment in the limits that the video store put on our relationships to movies than Netflix does in making everything immediate. It's actually depriving us of enjoyment.
Yeah, I think that's so well said. Friction and obstacles and diversion and kind of, you know, non-fulfillment, like, are part of enjoyment. They're essential to enjoyment. And I think that's why the culture of instant access doesn't make people happy, right? We have an epidemic of unhappiness, and a lot of that misery is about their work lives, but it's also just depression and anxiety because there isn't jouissance, because there's just flow.
Right. And it's difficult to, I mean, this is where the counterintuitive logic of psychoanalysis comes into play. But, you know, to quote the title of Todd's book, we enjoy what we don't have, or what we have trouble accessing or trouble getting, right? Like you were saying, limits, obstacles, frictions, right? And that's actually the source of enjoyment, which, again, people just tend to operate on a implicit level, like pleasure principle is all there is. It's just about, relieving excitation and returning to homeostasis. And it's like, no, that's not the primary motive force in us. And so, yeah, the more and more they make things immediate in the name of hyperfunctionality, the less all of us seem to be enjoying ourselves.
I think this ties back well to what you were saying about effortlessness, right? So this idea of everything's flow, everything's frictionless, where it's the style of no style. So everything's effortless, because you're saying the style requires effort. And I was going to say, yeah, so does becoming a violin virtuoso or understanding a difficult theorist. It requires effort, but effort's not cool anymore. Right. And so you're supposed to just think positive thoughts and manifest it, and it'll all work out. And so on that note of manifesting, I think this ties in well with my next question. I guess I'm going to steal it back from you here, Mikey, because
I wanted, before we go to the other stuff, I wanted to talk about anti-theory. Is that where you're going?
Yes. There's okay. one step before we get there. I wanted to talk about memoirs and memoirization and autofiction, and then we'll get to anti-theory, and because that's kind of the segue there, right?
Yeah.
And so I guess you said that it kind of became a thing after Michelle Obama's book Becoming, that's like the one thing you own is your own story, and you can tell that, and that's like the best way to get in the door with people in all these different ways, and you go a lot further with it. So I just kind of wanted to set you up here to maybe elaborate on the ways that memoirs and memorization and the idea that everybody feels like they need to articulate their story in some kind of like exciting new way, how that's a symptom of too late capitalism.
Sure. So when I'm trying to think about writing and literature and journalism and the internet and the genres of the internet, I'm trying to track a bunch of interesting kind of affinities. So one of those is that in the 21st century, the sale of memoirs that is tracked by the New York Times, quadruples over the 20th century. So that's a historical event, right? That is a shift in the market. Why is that, right? Another of those is that the personal essay, which has long existed as a genre for hundreds and hundreds of years and has had different, important cultural and institutional functions, becomes the dominant genre of internet writing when we have, in the 2010s. Why is that? And there are people who've, analyzed that and said, well, it's because we fired all the journalists, right? And that your own content is a way to fuel the content mill when it doesn't have to be researched and it doesn't have to be fact-checked and it doesn't have to be edited. And it's just, let me get more impressions. And also the more abject it is or the more disclosing it is, the more traffic it fuels, right? So if the business model is site impressions, not investing in the production of ideas that then people subscribe to or something. There also are trends towards what I call kind of memoirization of fiction, right? And so one of the things that I also look at with the aid of a computational analytics expert is that for most of its 300-year history, the novel is mostly written in the third person in English. And then that suddenly changes in the late 20th century. Why is there a decline in a form that has been pretty stable for almost 300 years, and a shift towards a privatization of perspective, or kind of enclosing of perspective, and a doing away with the unique properties of fiction, which really mostly happen in a third person, right? Omniscience is not something that we get to live with in our bodies, in our lives. So I try to put a bunch of things of that nature kind of on a level together and think, like, is there an explanation for all these convergences, which have to do with changing industrial conditions in publishing and changing industrial conditions in journalism, and the changing working conditions in higher education, or the changing availability of higher education. And what emerges is this just manifesting this ethos of personalism, of self-disclosure and self-actualization and self-revelation, that's the kind of meta-genre, right? That what's most important for people to write about is their own story, or what's most important for people to publish and get out there and face out, right, is their imminent experience that they are immediately living through. The idea that people would write many memoirs, like, instead of, like, waiting until they got old to write one or so, like, all of these phenomena have to be kind of accounted for. And when I try to account for that surging of the personal, it's again in those terms of, well, this isn't style. This is just me being me. This is just me being real. This is authenticity. This is, like, I'm not going to fake with you all, right? I'm not going to hide things. I'm not going to keep anything private, right? And that is itself like a response to these changing labor conditions that is just presenting itself as if it's spontaneous and as if it's, like, ethical and as if it's just, you know, intimate. And you know, there are all kinds of things that are really compelling in personal essays, and there are all kinds of things that are really compelling in people's tweets or in people's first person narratives, right? But there's also something that's lost if that's the only form of representation that we engage in, and there's definitely something that's lost if we act like it's just a kind of neutral ethical posture rather than something that has broader social determinations.
Yeah, and I think that this being played off like it's authentic and ethical is a great tie into how this bleeds into anti-theory as a radical, right? And mm-hmm. So the quote that I have here, I don't know if I'll read off the whole thing, but I have where you open up the section on anti-theory. You say, in his 700-page 2020 masterwork, Critique and Praxis, the Columbia Law professor, Foucauldian theory expert, NPR talking head, and death penalty lawyer Bernard Harcourt pronounces that critique has become too divorced from praxis. The praxis renewal to which he enjoins his fellow theorists is surprisingly not, however, collective action, but on the same wavelength as the immediatizing impulses of autofiction and stream aesthetics, in the same underpinning of circulatory disintermediation and imaginary inflation, anti-representational emancipation. So what is anti-representational emancipation?
Right. So there's just this idea that a number of theorists have taken up, a number of writers who we might call theorists have taken up, that it's not legitimate to participate in the project of theory, that it is not legitimate to make concepts, that it is not legitimate to try to generalize or abstract or get distance on a situation, try to historicize it, or to try to say it needs names, or that we need some new ways of thinking to shift our perspective around things. And instead, what is legitimate is just to evince your perspective, right? To manifest your individual ethos and voice, to only speak for yourself, because if you're trying to represent a social truth, or you're trying to speak on behalf of a class or your comrades or your social, you know, your social group and so on, that is just a kind of bad totalization or like, you know, unearned authority. And that what instead the theorist should do in the conditions of this illegitimate you know, abstraction is just pursue concretude, right? So just give me the body. Tell me about how you masturbate. Tell me about how you masturbate when you have cancer. Tell me about how much you suffer. Tell me about your process of self-revelation and self-exploration, and make sure that you tell us that you're humble, right? And that you're doing all this disclosing to not kind of pretend to speak for others, or to not pretend to have ideas that are resonant or transcendent. And I find that really a sad diminution of the historical task of theory. And I find it really common across a lot of kinds of disciplines, right? So Harcourt is obviously an incredible person in so many ways. Like, he's a death penalty lawyer for one, like, but his sense of what theory is at this moment is really, really attenuated. And that's in, you know, the kind of legal and political theory domain, but it is shared in anthropology, or it is shared in, you know, literary and creative writing, or it is shared in language study or in women's studies, or right. So why is that so shared? Why do we have this like retreat? Why do we have this kind of like ethical glamorization of what are some really degraded working conditions for producing theory? Because, you know, most professors have had their labor casualized and kind of precaritized and made very extreme, and library budgets have been slashed and research budgets have been slashed, and the, you know, kind of conditions for engaging in the slow, deliberative, collaborative work of making new ideas have been totally degraded by the assault on education, right? Why do you want to glamorize that degraded condition as humility, as weak theory, as one trend calls it, right? You know, humbly, right? That's what I'm trying to sort of track.
So a couple conceptual connections come to mind here for me, because I'm totally on your side on this one. So first of all, I mean, maybe I'm just pointing out some hypocrisy, but I do think it's odd that somebody who's supposedly so well versed in Foucault makes this move to putting all the emphasis on this egocentric self narrative. Yeah. When you think about Foucault as this great thinker of the epistemes and you know, orders of knowledge, you know, the order of things, all of this incredible research
he hated psychoanalysis for the, you know, trying to turn this like this injunction to speak into a virtue, right? Like, oh, I've got to tell my story.
He also rejected the subject. I mean, yeah. You know, so it's weird. It's like, I don't know how a Foucauldian, if he claims to be one, can even get here. It's a weird thing. So on the one hand, I think one of the things that does explain this type of move is the capitalist realism of theory, which is to say, if theorists believe that capital has won, there is no alternative to it, we're not going to actually think or theorize our way to something beyond or outside or radically modified within capitalism, then I guess the only salvation is my own personal salvation, because we've abandoned large scale projects. And so, I mean, one, I see the hypocrisy of a Foucauldian making this move. Two, I think capitalist realism does have a lot to do with it. And three, I just point out, like, it's the worst form of marrying ego psychology with metaphysics of presence, where this idea, like, oh, the locus of my meaning as a subject is my ego reciting its own interpretation of my story or whatever. I mean, as on Lacanian grounds, it's laughable, because my subjectivity or my unconscious is the discourse of the, it's out there in language. It's not something my ego sits there and just paints a picture of. It's within the cracks of language and in the forms of enjoyment and all that. And so on the one hand, like, it's like my ego becomes the center of all meaning, right? It's like ego logocentrism or something. And which, of course, I mean, the history of philosophy, that's exactly what philosophy would try to break down, is this sense that I'm the master of, I don't need to learn anything. whatever I think is tapped into the truth. I mean, it's doxological. It presupposes that whatever I think or presuppose about myself is just my absolute truth. Like, there's so much baggage in, you know, philosophically speaking, when it comes to this type of regression, that, yeah, I just see it as, you know, it's almost like a divine sanctioning of egotism, where now it's metaphysics of presence. Like, the whole meaning of everything is whatever you narrate in your story. This is totally anti-philosophy.
Well, yeah, it is incredibly well said. And you can tell that there's something at stake about, when I say illegitimate, about like the discrediting of the history of philosophy, right? And some sense that I call it like an overcorrection at one point, right? That you want to have a critique of, you know, master epistemic formations. You want to have a critique of objectivity that is not really objectivity, or of voices that are excluded from the narratives of history, grand narratives of history, or from the kind of philosophy of science, or from philosophy itself, right? But that doesn't mean that the critique has to be about just wholly deflating, puncturing, and discrediting the effort to make knowledge and to kind of synthesize and bring things together that represent, you know, multiple kinds of people, or represent collective interest, or even represent like the interests of the species at a time of forced extinction or an unevenly distributed threat. It's really disappointing. And what is also disappointing about it is that one of the other historical jobs of theory besides synthesis is to reflect on its own conditions of knowledge making, right? And to me, what you're calling this kind of egoism and this metaphysics of presence, it just has way too much rhyme with the sort of incitement to presencing that the data companies want, right? So we are enjoined to manifest and to do that on TikTok so that they can, you know, harvest user data. We don't have to believe the kind of smoke and mirrors about how profitable or not, or generative or not, data is, to know that these are the companies that are valued the most right now, right? And that we have algorithmic imperatives and economic imperatives to do this form of charismatic emanation, being an influencer, sharing, and more sharing, and so on. And for philosophy and theory to take that as its posture and to take that as its remit and its task without reflecting on that being ordained by the economic base, it's really falling down on the job.
I keep going back to this. It's just such a strange position for a Foucauldian. Do you think somebody can get there? Like, this whole thing of like almost this fetishization of the self expressing itself. Could a Foucauldian, because when I think Foucault, I think of the early books, I think of these great analyses of structure, right? Could a Foucauldian try to do this on the grounds of the care of the self stuff in Foucault?
Absolutely, I think they could. I mean, you know, one has to argue this out and think about what Foucault's own trajectory was. But, you know, there are already arguments about how his kind of suspicion about, the public health administration and the public health incitement to discourse and the massification of control of the body politic, how that knowledge formation translates into a kind of suspicion of the social welfare state for him, or a suspicion of public health agencies, right? It's not an accident that some of our most prominent Foucauldians were against masking or COVID denialists or so on. It is a late development in some of the later works that that there is a kind of glorification of ethos and of various forms of inward turn in response to the anatomy of power. I think you could get there, which doesn't invalidate how incredibly youthful and powerful like other Foucauldian brains might be, you know.
I just want to say
the whole thing about like the overreach of the state, or how, you know, it fails to help us with mental illness or what. It's just like, yeah, because abandoning us to capital really helps, you know. Right.
Mm-hmm. But, well, Dave, no, go ahead. It went too far in a lot of ways, this sort of Foucauldian emphasis on, you know, like, oh, you know, well, mental health is kind of just like a social construct, right? Like, that's, I think, mm-hmm. that's kind of a way it gets inherited. And that's not necessarily all his fault, right? People are trying to figure out a way of navigating this that doesn't stigmatize as much, but it obviously goes too far sometimes. I do want to say, I mean, I'm a little sympathetic to Agamben when it comes to the COVID, the whole thing, really the whole thing. I'm a little sympathetic because I don't think that was handled well, but, I think where you and also Todd are coming from on that position is a reasonable one, and it's worth taking seriously. And it's not what I want to get into right now. So much as to say, like, the situation, whatever the actual situation is, and if we are to actually diagnose the situation in a way that would be generative of actual solutions that can actually change anything or give us any kind of a real future, cannot be understood with a bunch of people in the room just telling you what they think or how they felt this week. Like, that's, I guess that's kind of what it comes back to with theory for me, because I've had, you know, over the course of the last 10 years, a lot of experiences in various organizing spaces, where there is this, as Alex Cernicek Nick Cernicek and Alex Williams would both say, that was a funny slip, folk politics, right? Like the kind of circles where it's just, we'll just kind of sort out like how we feel about things and work on how we say, and how we say things so that we'll all be happy at the end of it. Like it's kind of this Occupy direct democracy ideal. And I'm sympathetic to it in various cases, in various situations, right? But it tends to be the go-to. And my problem with that is just that you're not going to get down to the logic of capital and how it actually is working today by being this kind of concrete that is not actually concrete in the first place, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, but you're also not going to get to collective power, right? So there's sort of like, we need concepts and we live in a fairly totalizing system, and yet it's hard to represent that totality, right? And so we need the history of ideas to help us, and we need analytic frameworks, and we need expertise, and we need concepts and theory. It's not just going to come out of our belly button, even though I bet anybody who works in the warehouse with you has things that they could say on any given day about their working experience that would be very revealing about capitalism, right? And let's not forget, of course, Das Kapital as a book is made out of lots of testimony of workers and factories, and then testimony of people who were hired as government social scientists about factory conditions and so on, right? So you composite all these voices together, and there's lots of legitimate things there, but that you do need kind of bigger frames or abstraction and perspective. But the other piece of that is that you also need vehicles for collective power. So if your notion of organizing is just like, we have a conversation in which everybody shares their experience and nobody takes the lead, and there's no momentum or vision or plan, because we think that plans are domination, or that having an agenda is bad or instrumentalist, or that we don't want to have a leader, or we don't want to have a formation for sustaining our exercise of collective power. That doesn't go anywhere politically. You know, it's kind of like, it makes us feel ethically good about our stasis, but it's not a real mobilization. And I am really interested in what kind of our contemporary faux politics or anti-politics, how those might be named with immediacy as well. This repudiation of structures of mediation, like sometimes hierarchy is useful in an organization. Sometimes delegation is useful in an organization. You do need to believe in representation to let somebody, you know, take, I'm going to take this post and I am going to speak for our collective interests, or I am going to come up with a set of demands or a slogan or some articles for a union contract, and they're going to speak adequately to our situation in a way that will better it, even though not every single person wrote that article or something, you know, of the contract. So it's that suspicion of integrated representations, suspicion of kind of vehicles for ensuring repeatability or ensuring sustainability of collective betterment and collective power that I would think immediacy can help kind of name.
You know, what I hear what you're saying in that is, look, on some level, I believe in what I call trickle-down theory. So, you know, Heidegger and Sartre, they could write stuff, you know, this immensely detailed theorizing about death. And then, you know, 100 years later, you hear Dr. Phil say something in some existentialist key that if you really wanted to trace it back, it's like he got some trickle-down Heidegger, trickle-down Sartre, right? And he's using, I think so much of this tendency we see on the left to reject form, reject hierarchy, reject structure is an unfortunate inheritance from Deleuze and Guattari. And so much of this, the horizontalism, the rhizomatics, all of this basically says, look, we're not doing structural forms because form itself is oppressive. I mean, Nick Land, who I know a lot of Deleuze Guattarians wouldn't want to own as one of their own, but when Nick was in his core Deleuze Guattarian phase, one of his famous statements was organization is suppression. And you know, you really hear this Deleuze Guattarian resonance in that everything's about lines of flight outside of the apparatus of capture and all of that. And this, I mean, this gets us to what I really wanted to ask you about your book Order of Forms. But I mean, I'll save the next part, let you respond. But I mean, do you see this tendency, you know, obviously the anti-representationalism that's in Deleuze and Guattari, the anti-form, do you see them playing a key role in like this idea kind of trickling down to your typical leftists on a campus, you know, rejecting form, structure, planning, right, et cetera?
Okay, so I think that that's actually an extremely hard question. I think I see convergence between theoretical immanentism, theoretical vitalism, and the like anti-politics or the repudiation of mediation or the attacks on organization and structure that are politically practical and operative. I see convergence there. I'm not sure that I see cause there, even though I think you're right that there's been a lot of metabolizing of theory by contemporary culture, right? So thing like a book like Judith Butler's Gender Trouble, it has actually been incredibly influential in culture, right? Generations of like first year gender studies students have read it, but also kids in gen ed classes have read it, you know, and it made some effect on them. And that adds up to some cultural values and some cultural meaning. But I, because maybe it's too vulgar, but because I'm, you know, more of a Marxist, I think in terms of what shapes the conditions for thought, right? That theory doesn't happen in a vacuum. And so to me, that's why it's so important that I'm trying to sort of say, gosh, a lot of what we think of as theory right now really is doing the work of algorithmicization, really is doing the work of the, you know, disintermediation. And it's not reflecting on its conditions of emergence. It's not reflecting on that convergence. I don't think it's that the theories are causing that necessarily, or I think it would be hard to track out, right? I think the rhymes and affinities that you identify are real. And I think there can be all kinds of reinforcing effects too. But I don't think that ideas necessarily totally cause the historical or political formations in that way, especially not ideas whose dissemination is kind of limited, even though we have all these like cool podcasts to help us, you know, do it. But I just think that the material conditions drive things a little bit more. But it's a hard question. How can we think about those convergences and also hold theorists accountable without maybe attributing causality?
Just a follow up. Go ahead.
I just have to put in like this right there. I've taken that to be like the causal thing about about how philosophy trickles down. It's really interesting because also arguably what makes a thinker's work or stick, is that it in some way, is able to articulate at a higher level, maybe, but articulate something that is already going on and that people are already experiencing, right? And so then it's like Deleuze and Guattari were just the most creative and most interesting at articulating this sort of new left, sort of hippie acid left kind of approach, which, and I just wanted to say, like, that's the other thing is like, you don't have to do theory to come to basic Deleuze and Guattarian sort of commitments or experiences. All you need is some acid or some mushrooms. And that's Mikey's never done either. So we can kind of forgive him for not knowing that, but all you got to do is eat some and you'll be a Deleuzian. It's pretty easy, you know. Don't bother with 1,000 plateaus, people. You just go eat the thing. But actually, I would say don't. Okay, now I've got to walk it back. In all reality, though, I would say that getting it conceptually, there's like a staying power there that you otherwise, if you were to say just do psychedelics, you get like the experience and then it wears away and then you're back to life. Concepts, they actually stick with you in a way that drug-induced experiences don't. Sorry, yeah, Mikey, there you go.
Okay, so totally agree. I guess for me, what I'm saying as far as trickle-down theory goes is just there's almost like you have D&G and then you have the main thinkers, Masumi and Parton Negri and Land and the CCR. You had all these main students or offshoots of D&G, and then it just kind of gets watered down, and then, you know, activists use it to think through basic things they're going through, and it kind of just gets boiled down almost to a spirit or a tendency, and a lot of the nuance is lost in how it's applied. But I mean, look, what I said about D&G, I always go out of my way, because yes, I'm some kind of Lacanian Zizekian. But I have an immense respect for Deleuze. I think Difference in Repetitions, I always say it's one of the greatest works of metaphysics ever written. So it comes from a place of respect for Deleuze in particular. But the thing I wanted to ask you, though, about form and then what you call anarcho-vitalism is that so much of the left, part of one of these kind of general spirits that does seem influenced by D&G in some way, is, but also Marcuse, there's other ones. Like the mission of the left should be to liberate enjoyment or liberate desire, to let it free flow and not get caught up in prohibitions or et cetera, right? And so, and a lot of people would go, wait, aren't you, you're a Lacanian, you're all about jouissance. But the whole point of Lacan and Zizek, like, you're never going to get it. Like, that can't be your mission is, you know, jouissance is completely playing a role in everything we do, politics, ideology, but you can't make it like the goal. The whole point is that jouissance is in undermining your goals. So it can't be the goal. And so I think a left that is based on, let's call it the liberation of libido and having, you know, no restrictions, no prohibitions, nothing placed on it, like somehow that's the end all be all. D&G would call it the new earth, right? Like, what's your thinking on this relationship between form and this impulse of like libidinal vitalism on the left?
I think it is a really interesting question, and I think that it's really important that not all theory is the same, and that this is a kind of line in the sand we could draw between a psychoanalytic conception that constraints are enabling, that desire is activated by and through misdirection, that drive is not a program, right? That mediation, intervention, distraction, indirection, that is essential for the structuring of desire and enjoyment. And then and in that way, you get this affirmation of structure as such, right? That the symbolic is the condition of our freedom, that there is structuration is essential for any kind of subject experience, right? Any kind of subjectivity. That's a psychoanalytic position, and it is on a line, on the other side of a line from this more ecstatic, vitalist, structurelessness, formlessness kind of program. I really think psychoanalysis is different from a lot of other theories. One way to name that difference might be to say it's a dialectical theory, and that it has that in common with Marxism and these other kinds that repudiate structuration or division or mediation are immanentist or non-dialectical, right? They want to overcome rifts or contradictions, or they want to overcome negations in a kind of, again, undialectical way. And that you get this kind of, enthusiasm for and spiritual ecstasy of formlessness. And it's very hard for me not to think about those in terms of just manifestation now, but the kind of sense that their freedom is on the side of unstructured life or immediacy or, deinstitutionalized, demolished relations or anti-politics, as opposed to freedom is enabled by structure. I think it's a real divide. And when I'm trying to think about that side, I think is wrong, the immanentist side, I'm often trying to think about how it has aesthetic prejudices and aesthetic truisms that get kind of molted into political ones. So this kind of modernist sense of breaking or fragmentation or dissolution or rupture or irresolution formally becomes this kind of preference for the organization is suppression, political position, right?
I think we're just about at time here, but I do have a sort of closing question. Assuming we got to the main ones here for you, Mikey, right? We're good to.
I only had one other one, which was, and I did want to let the viewers know, so you wrote a book on Fight Club, and just for a moment, would you give us a kind of summary of what you're doing in that book and also what you think the enduring legacy of this film is?
Okay, sure. So what I'm doing in that book, it's a textbook. It's in a series where we take a contemporary classic film that's taught a lot, but doesn't have a BFI book, and Todd edits the series. And we come up with a relationship between this classic film and a theoretical tradition as an approach to film. And so the book is organized like, here's how the theoretical tradition works and how you can use it. And then here's how it works when we think with this film, right? So in my case, I'm doing Fight Club, and I am doing the tradition of Marxist film theory, or the kind of untraditional Marxist film theory, because I'm kind of telling the story of how film theory was pretty Marxist in a lot of its origins and then became less so over time. And I'm trying to help us think about what are Marxist questions that we ask about cultural products like film. And then that film in particular is so interesting because it wants to offer a theory of capitalism. It wants to offer a theory of alienation. It wants to offer a theory of schizophrenia as a byproduct of capitalist worker relations and alienation. And it wants to try really hard to experiment with some different political responses and collectivist political responses. And it is a film of exploration of failed experiments. And it's really important to fail and to continue to fail better. And they move in the film through the course of some different experiments. at the same time as it is that picture of capitalism and that picture of kind of some political responses or some efforts to be, you know, critically collective and against capitalism, it's also a film that is really, really invested in interrogating the role of images in holding capitalism in place, the role of Hollywood films and of the commercial industry and the, you know, to go back to Adorno in our earlier conversation, right? The way that those two things often function so close together. What provides the glue that holds us in place or keeps us in a very immiserating system? A lot of the time it is the film industry or it is the entertainment we consume. And I think that Fight Club is just so, so insightful about that. You know, everything from how it calls our attention to cinematic editing and the whole kind of sequences of splicing the porn into the kids' films and the fact that Tyler works as a projector and so on. And to its kind of contrast between Edward Norton's image and Brad Pitt's image. So it just, and then all of its kind of meta cinema references. So it just kind of attunes us to ideology as well as to capitalist production, as well as to efforts at anti-capitalist politics. And I think it's really interesting to think with. Yeah.
That's great. So, I mean, cause here's the thing, I'm a big defender of the film. I think it's arguably one of the greatest filmic critiques of consumerism we have. Mm-hmm. And, but online nowadays, there's this, especially with certain leftist types, liberal leftist types, who'll just say all the film is a toxic or is a defense of toxic masculinity. And it's just trying to celebrate and champion the worst forms of masculinity. And I think they missed the whole point of the film. I think it's a critique of that. I mean, the whole thing is right. Like ultimately by the end of the film, what has liberated him is honestly a Badouian love event, right? It's, it's a loss of this kind of like overinvestment in independent masculinity. At least that's how I read it as a, you know,
And what has capacitated their politics is shared labor of social reproduction, right? When they move into the house, they're cooking in teams, they're sleeping in teams, they're washing in teams, they're making soap. They are all doing this feminized work, right? And that is the, and they're doing lots and lots of communications labor, right? And that's the condition of possibility of their effective political act of bombing the credit card industry buildings and nobody who works in them gets hurt. I mean, especially not security guards and so on, right? So that there's this whole passage through a practice of social reproduction, I think is really not an apology for toxic masculinity. Yeah.
I figured, but good to know. Dave, you want to take it away?
Well, it's great to hear you say that because I think, how long ago was it when I first brought you to Boise State to give that talk about Baudrillard and
Fight Club. We're going on what, 6 years ago, 7 years ago?
Yeah, it's been a while.
It's been a while. I think 2018, right?
Yeah, I think so. And so this was the first time that I'd met Mikey.
Because it's a year before the Zizek conference, so 2017, I think.
Okay, there we go. Yeah, because then we met Zizek a year later. So this was the first time I ever met Mikey in real life was when I was organizing with some organizations at a university, brought Mikey to come give talks on Baudrillard, really whatever he wanted to talk about. We just wanted to bring him. And then like a year later, we got to meet again at the Zizek conference in Athens, Georgia. But anyway, after he gave the talk on Fight Club, a professor there came up to me and said that she fucking hates Fight Club, you know. She's just like, and she basically said that everything that Mikey just said is at this point kind of tropish online when it comes to that. And so anyway, I'm glad you see beyond that, though. Of course, also, I think there are people who glorify Tyler Durden in this way, so of course we can kind of see where they're getting that from. But I wanted to bring it back around here just before we close out. Like, I entered a sort of crisis, and I think it's a crisis imposed by this culture of immediacy or this style of immediacy. And that is whether or not to stream this interview. You know, let's get really meta here for a second. So because I called up Nance. Nance is often a co-host at Theory Underground, and I was like, hey, just checking to see if you were gonna be here for the interview. And he's like, oh, I'm just gonna watch it live because I'm out doing things. And I was like, oh, I had it. I don't think I'm gonna do a live, but I was thinking about doing a live. I've been kind of like vacillating on this back and forth, and it's interesting because like we were going to do it live on February 22nd for the Epic Marathon stream, but because that didn't work for you, we did it this Monday. Well, the thing is, yeah, I could have streamed it pretty easy with a few clicks of a button and everything like that, but I was like, oh, I'd have to make a thumbnail. In a sort of sense, putting like the instantaneity, like giving people instantaneous access to this interview would have required more preparation that I just didn't have in the time crunch of today. And so I thought that was like interesting that putting on like this effortless instantaneous access actually required more steps than just jumping in the Zoom call and recording it. But then at the level of like media and just like what it actually does to our perception, our takeaway from experience, how it really mediates things like this conversation itself. I'm curious what you both might think would have been different if this had been live as opposed to doing it not live.
I mean, I think it's really important that you point out that it takes work to make something seem instantaneous, right? It takes, you have to be able to have the time ahead of time to package it that way or to configure it that way, right? And I think that you guys know better than anybody the work that goes into instant fulfillment, the work that goes into this culture of speed and this culture of instantaneity. How our conversation might have been different. I mean, maybe we would, you guys are, it's your natural milieu to live stream. But I might have, you know, prepped a little differently or had a different water bottle or made sure that I was in my other office or something if I thought it was going to be live. We might have talked differently. But I also think that the conversations around it happen differently, right? So because now you can sort of think together, do we want to edit this a little bit? Is there anything that we said that we shouldn't have said or anything that Anna gave a just dumb and meandering answer to? No. You know, that we could just cut that out. And you'll be able to sort of also maybe prime your audiences for it, right? Like I often see that Mikey makes a Facebook post that's like, I'm so excited that I got to talk to so-and-so and I can't wait to show it to you guys, right? Like that there's a little bit of cultivation of sort of pre-ideas or framing for people, anticipation, like, and I think those are all good virtues, you know? But I don't know, do you think you would have done it differently if you were streaming, Mikey?
So here's the thing. I mean, and it's similar. Like I see this McLuhanite dimension to how you're thinking about all of this. And it's crazy how just one different variable in a medium can totally change what the messages are. Right. So, for example, if we were streaming live and the live chat was going the whole time, that's totally going to affect, it's going to, even if we're not aware of yeah. it at some preconscious implicit level, it's going to shape or affect what we say, how we say it. And so that one variable in defining the difference between live streaming or just uploading the video later, this is where McLuhan would go, yo, they're not the same medium. There's this one variable in particular that's different. And it does, it shapes and crafts what we say. And so I know we wanted to ask you all these questions, but yeah, I think if we live streamed it, if we could do like, you know, a multiversal comparison, like we go to the one alternate universe where we have live streamed it, we'd see the differences between what was communicated here.
Yeah. And I guess it's making me think a lot about how immediacy, I mean, and your work is making me think a lot about how immediacy has sort of permeated or structured the almost everything about what I do with my channel now. I don't make video essays anymore. I used to, right? Video essays take a lot more work. And it's like, no, but I can just kind of click go and start talking, you know? And somebody who wants this sort of like neutralizing effect of like this bit of distance where it's like, they don't see you talking, and it's like, maybe there's some words on the screen, maybe there's some pictures on the screen, maybe there's overlay some video. All of that takes a lot of work, and it's just, I don't have the relative time energy to be able to pull that off. And maybe I just tell myself that, and I don't know. Cause like, I'm also thinking, it's like, well, like there's different approaches where you just, it's all you do is like one video essay per month. You don't have to do all kinds of stuff every month. Right. And so it's like, how much am I like a sort of personification or like symptom of our moment, in that I'm doing so much stuff that is live. I never edit, right? Unless somebody makes a special request, I never edit, because everything we do is great. I mean, and if there's somebody out there who's like, oh my God, Dave fumbled that question, I don't care, man. I mean, I don't want them in my audience anyway. They can go away, you know? But I guess that sort of, that vibe is also part of like this, like stimulation of some, I think it plays into this idea of like authenticity, right? Like there's something that people are getting from this channel that they're not getting elsewhere, because I don't care or whatever, you know? And that's part of it. And so it's a really good sort of sobering take. And so everybody definitely check out Anna's new book called Immediacy, or The Style of Too Late Capitalism. It was really great to meet you. We'd love to have you back soon. Any last thoughts? We'll kind of give you the last word here.
I mean, I just think that what you just said is so interesting about the bind, because there's a hustle about all of this content. And like, why isn't it enough to have one carefully produced slow video, for instance, video essay, right? That's a hard to make form, and it takes your skill and it takes your time. But on the other hand, you guys are doing such important work, right? And everybody needs to have ideas. They're vivifying, and you want to get your ideas out there, and you want to keep your community going in the live stream conversation. Maybe people make friends in it and make binds that will sustain them forward in other ways. So I think it's a hard call I see for you. But definitely just starting to reflect on how some of our choices that we might think are just about our preferences are part of these broader logics is just like the key.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you for having
thank
me.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Thank Take you care. For reading too.
We cannot do direct revolution, but the only way to lay the foundation for it is to do what you are doing to move the underground. It's a theoretically correct title.
Welcome to Theory Underground, where workers with earbuds can find genuine liberation from necessity.
Research at Theory Underground focuses on what is most important for understanding our current situation.
All right, everybody, whether you watched and or listened to this on YouTube or listened to this via podcast, I just wanted to say thank you for making it to the end. I hope you found this worthwhile. If you got distracted along the way, tuned in and out, no worries. At least now you kind of have a sense for the territory and what it's good for and whether or not it's worth coming back to in the future, which is ultimately what it's all about. And so I just wanted to make a couple quick plugs here as far as ways that you can get involved at Theory Underground. So the main thing is that we have weekly events and we have monthly events, and then we have special courses. Now the special courses are like usually a one-off thing, right? It might be a short course, it might be a long course. Courses might include things like Mikey teaching Slavoj Žižek's For They Don't Know What They Do, or Leon Brenner teaching clinical structures and autism in psychoanalysis, or me teaching Being in Time or Totality and Infinity. But I think one of the coolest ways to get involved, if you don't have the time and or money for a full-on course right now, is to check out the ongoing seminars. There are two that take place. One is on the second Sunday of every month. The other is on the fourth Sunday of every month. And then there's a sort of floating discussion that changes whether it's the first or the third or sometimes the fifth Sunday of a month. That's kind of just agreed upon depending on my availability and my wife's availability. So the two of us do these lecture sessions for critical media theory and critical doxology and time energy. Those two ongoing seminars are part of research cohorts for people who want to do writing on these topics, or people who might want to use a critical media theory or critical doxology and time energy theory for their own projects. And so this is like a way to get a basis in these fields, but it's also a way to kind of get to know people who are really working on the main research threads here at Theory Underground. Subscribers also get access to the weekly events, which are Capital Mondays every Monday, variable times for that. Just if you are interested and you sign up as a subscriber, just reach out to me and I'll add you to that list. And then we also do these multilingualism immersion sessions where we on Wednesday do Club Español at 3 p.m. Eastern time. On Thursdays at 10 a.m. Eastern time, we are joined by Terrence Blake. And if you haven't watched the interview that we did with him, you got to check it out. He's a really cool guy. He's been speaking French and writing it and doing theory in French, studying under people like Deleuze and Foucault back in the day. And now here he is teaching us all French. So definitely check that out. And then Solitariat is health and fitness. This is where we just do a check-in. It's a quick 40-minute in and out. Once per week, we just talk about like what kinds of physical activities have we been doing? What kinds of diet choices are we making? And what's something we're going to try to do different this week? Like that kind of check-in. It's almost like I feel like it's like a sort of secular confessional, but it does help me kind of stay on top of my game. It often inspires me to go on an extra run or go hit the gym, whatever, you know, stuff like that. Stuff that thinkers need, right? American thinkers need multilingualism immersion. American thinkers need health and fitness because it's too easy for us to get just stuck in the reading and the writing and the scrolling on the phones and all of that kind of stuff, especially when we don't have the time, energy, especially when we're constantly busy. Having some kind of a structure, accountability, some kind of a check-in, that really helps me. And that's why it's ultimately here, because I find it useful. Nance finds it useful. A handful of other people find it useful. And so if you want in, this is a great way to get to know us. But also every month we have other events that are just like these monthly events. These are just a few of the things that we're currently doing. There's a lot more coming. Right now, the app and the website are buggy and beta. And so don't trust them at all. The best way to know what's going on is to become a subscriber. Hit me up. Like, let me know what you're most interested in. And we'll go from there. I guess the last thing I want to say is, big thank you to my patrons over at Patreon. So the difference between a subscriber and a patron is the subscriber is giving me anywhere between $30 and $300 a month so that they can be involved in all of these activities.
Think of it like a gym membership, but for your mind.
If you don't care so much about the theory courses or the ongoing seminars or the multilingualism immersion events or the health and fitness or the film club stuff, if that none of that really matters to you, but you want to support, then the best way to do that is to become a patron. And so thank you. Big, big thank you to Nico and Zakil and Zoxandra and Darian Large. You're really helping make a difference here, because as of 2 weeks ago, I started skipping work at Amazon. Thank you. It really means the world to me that people are supporting me on Patreon, that people are monthly subscribers, that people maybe just want a one-off course, but ultimately, you're all the best. And if you're kind of like, hey, I can't do any of that stuff and I'm broke, motherfucker, well, don't worry. There is a scholarship if you want to get involved. But if you don't and you just like the content, then hit the like button, comment, let me know what you think about something that happened. What was your favorite quote from the whole live stream? What was something that somebody said that you thought was a great moment? Maybe timestamp it. I love that stuff. But if you're on the podcast, make sure to review the Theory Underground podcast. Thank you, everybody. Take care. All right. I know this is like already the longest PSA in the world, but there's a lot of stuff going on at Theory Underground. I just wanted to make this quick insertion to also remind you that there is the Theory Underground European tour happening between April 27th and May 25th. The dates and locations are almost secured, and you can see them right here on the whiteboard, as well as the October conference happening in Boise. It's going to happen between the 24th and 26th. And, I think that's going to be a lot of fun. You can check out the call for proposals on that. Should be up on the channel now.